From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Anne Davila Cardinal, whose supernatural young adult thriller is Category 5, published by Tor Teen. Anne Davila Cardinal is also the author of Five Midnights. She is the director of student recruitment for Vermont College of Fine Arts, VCFA, where she earned her MFA in writing. She also helped create VCFA's winter writing residency in Puerto Rico. She comes from a long line of Puerto Rican writers, including poets Virgilio and José Antonio Davila, and her cousin, award-winning fiction writer Tere Davila. Anne lives north of Stowe, Vermont, with her husband Doug and son Carlos, and likes to spend her free time cycling, doing fiber arts, and preparing for the zombie apocalypse. Here's a little information about Category 5. After the hurricane, some see destruction, and some smell blood. The tiny island of Vieques, located just off the northeastern coast of the main island of Puerto Rico, is trying to recover after Hurricane Maria, but the already battered island is now half empty. To make matters worse, as on the main island, developers have come in to buy up the land at a fraction of its worth, taking advantage of the island when it is down. Lupe, Javier, and Marisol, the protagonists of Five Midnights, are back to investigate a series of murders that follow in the wake of a hurricane and in the shadow of a new supernatural threat. When I spoke with Anne Davila Cardinal, I asked her to start by talking about her own connection to Puerto Rico, the setting of Category 5. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
My mother was from Bayamón, Puerto Rico, and so I'm half. And ever since I was a child, I mean, I went every summer in childhood. And then at a certain point after my father died, when I was 8, my mother started sending me down there because all my siblings were quite a bit older. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest, and it sort of, she didn't really want to deal with it. At that time she was drinking. And so she would send me down to Puerto Rico to her family. And the thing is that they, it's a very family-oriented culture, and they took incredible care of me and got my teeth fixed and, you know, and brought me to amusement parks. And so I have this, in the reason I identify so strongly as a Puerto Rican is because they essentially saved my life, is how I look at it.
Wow.
And so as an adult, after my mother sobered up when I was 13, and our relationship, we mended our relationship, and it was really good, but it's very hard to go back. But after she died, we were all in Vermont at that point. I started going down yearly because it was my way of connecting with her. And so I started bringing my son and seeing Puerto Rico in a different light, because I used to just have no control. And I was sitting in a rocking chair with a bunch of old ladies while they talked. And now I get to go and go to the beach and to go to the rainforest and do the things that I want to do. Plus see my family. So it's like I have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's interesting. So as you've been speaking, certain aspects of your plot line have come together for me. So you're channeling Lupe a little bit, or she's channeling you, I think.
Yeah, she has a part. She's definitely a part of me. Actually, so is Javier. It's almost like they're two different parts. But Lupe is kind of, it's funny because when particularly adults reviewed my book, Five Midnights, they couldn't stand Lupe, particularly men. They were like, she's too shrill. She's too, you know, combative. And I'm like, do you know any teenage girls? Seriously. But the thing is, Lupe is who I wished I was, because I didn't fight back as much as I wish I had.
Okay.
So she has elements of my story, definitely.
Yeah, and she's very, we've moved on to character, which I wasn't necessarily going to get to yet. But in fact, while we're on her, you know, she's very independent. She is what we would hope for maybe our children's generation. I don't think, so you and I are the same age, but I don't know that we had that kind of determination and independence like we would like our daughters to have, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a word a friend of mine used to use called tamped, like you tamp out a flame. And our generation, women were tamped a lot. It was like they hire you because of your fire and your energy, and then they spend a lot of time trying to tamp it down.
Yeah.
And so with Lupe and with my son, Carlos, who I raised, I was like, what would happen if they're untamped?
Yeah.
And that's sort of where Lupe came from.
Great. Okay, wonderful. So just getting back to your connection to Puerto Rico, this to me explains a lot about how you know about, for example, the Flor de Maga or the Caimito trees and other local knowledge. Or did you have to do a lot of research to get to that sort of detail level?
The most of it is from my experience and from my travels down there. And, you know, there was a certain amount of texting my uncle Esteban, because I actually have an uncle Esteban who actually does work for the police force. And I would text him, I'd say, Tio, what kind of a gun would a drug dealer in Old San Juan use? And he wouldn't even question it, because you can't Google that kind of thing. And so he wouldn't even question it. He would answer me. And then I would say, okay, thanks, and go on. And it was very funny. Him and my cousin Carlos, who would just answer other questions, random questions, and not even ask why.
Yeah.
I think they're used to me by now.
Now, that's an interesting point. So you used Esteban's name, and you also used Davila, and that was interesting to me. Do you want to talk about that decision?
Sure. Lupe was actually named Davila before I was, in terms of legally. It's my mother's maiden name, and Cardinal's my married name. That's my husband's name, which I love. And I've been a hagman for a very long time, and I started writing Five Midnights, and I named her Lupe Davila. Lupe was a nickname they'd given me when I worked for New York City Ballet. That's a long, bizarre story, but it was what more people called me than Anne. And so I said, I'm going to just give her a piece of me. And so I named her Lupe Davila, and I asked Esteban, can I name this? I'm going to make you chief police. Can I name him after you? And he says, sure. He was very pleased. And so she was actually legally a Davila before I was. And then I decided to change my name, my middle name legally, to Davila, so that I retain some of that. And also my family, I come from a literary family on the island, so I wanted to sort of own that and be part of that heritage.
Right. Okay. Now, we've sort of mentioned it, but in case any listeners don't know, your first book is Five Midnights, which has many of these same characters. When you wrote Five Midnights, did you know that you would be writing a sequel, or is this going to be a series? That's the other question I was curious about.
I don't think it's going to be a series, although you never know. But I wrote when I was I had a two-book deal with Tortine. Loved my editor there, Ollie Fisher. And so I was excited about the second book. And I had proposed several options, and one of them was a sequel, which she chose. But while I was in copy edits for Five Midnights, Hurricane Maria happened.
Right.
And for any Puerto Rican, life is before Maria and after. And
right.
So I felt like I had not addressing that would be irresponsible of me. And so I had this concept of these ghost figures and putting it on Vieques, which is such an incredible place. And so I decided to pull in the hurricane and then make it during the recovery. And so the Category 5 took shape and filled out after the fact. But we're going to, you know, she had agreed to the proposal for the sequel ahead of time.
Okay. Interesting. I was going to ask you about that, whether you had another book in the drawer that had to be shelved when the hurricane hit and you suddenly decided this is what I really need to be writing about.
Not really.
Okay. Were supernatural books your favorites when you were growing up?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I was thinking about this a lot lately because while promoting this book, I've made these connections in the horror field, and I was raised on Creature Feature, you know, that was like, I think it was every Friday or Saturday night, there were horror movies, and I have three brothers, older brothers, so we all sort of would watch it. My mother was obsessed with Gothic literature. We always had it around the house. And so I grew up with that. And I had nightmares every night. People always say I'm too afraid to read horror, and I'm like, well, I'm afraid too. That's kind of the point.
Yeah.
And so because it's a safe way to sort of deal with the, you know, scary things, and so I started reading horror comics when I was after my father died, and and was obsessed. And so it and Stephen King, you know, when I was a teen and all these things, I definitely, it is the genre I keep going back to.
Yeah. Now, do you remember ever remember watching Night Stalker?
Absolutely.
Or the other one was Ghost Story with Sebastian Cabot. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember Sebastian Cabot. I'm not sure about Ghost Story. I love The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And in fact, there are these two books. We had a book. It was pink. And I had this memory of this short stories, a Twilight Zone collection. And I just found it on eBay. And I'm so excited. And the thing that's interesting, I remember the stories. There's some horrible stories in there that I still think about. But it's actually written for young people, and I didn't know that. Here I thought that I'd grabbed, like, you know, my mother's book, and it turns out that these are actually sort of Twilight Zone-esque short stories intentionally for young people.
Wow.
So I'm excited to dig in.
Yeah, great. Now, as an author, do supernatural plots come pretty naturally to you, so to speak, naturally? Or do you kind of have to work at finding what's going to happen?
My books actually start with the supernatural concept.
Right.
It's the thing that interests me the most. A friend of mine, I was in a crime anthology recently called Lockdown, and it was such an honor because there's such incredible writers in it, but a lot of them are crime. And somebody said to me, you know, why don't you write crime? I said, no. If there's a body in my book, I want it to get up again. and that's essentially how I feel about it. It's like I've realized, I mean, I write primarily young adult at this point, though I do have an adult book that I wrote at BCSA that I'm working on. But I primarily write young adult, and I read a lot of young adult, and contemporary doesn't appeal to me that much unless it has a supernatural element.
Okay.
I just find it fun and interesting, and I also want to appeal to teens who respond to that like I did.
Now, your first book, Five Midnights, had to do with a Puerto Rican, I guess, demon or lore of, is it El Cuco? Is that what it's called?
Yep. He's the Hispanic boogeyman.
Okay. So do you do a lot of research into local mythology and lore as you worked on these books about Puerto Rico?
I actually, you know, I have my whole life. I mean, I find it fascinating.
Okay.
And because what a culture is afraid of says so much about, it's an anthropological gold mine.
Yes.
And so, you know, I remember hearing about El Cuco. My mother did not threaten me with such things. It wouldn't have worked. But she, you know, I read about him, and then I found out that he exists in pretty much every Hispanic culture around the world. And I found that amazing. And I always say there was a particular time as a parent myself where I felt like I had no power. And so the idea of being able to call forth, you know, this sort of boogeyman to threaten your children with, I mean, and also the idea of threatening children with this before they go to bed is just fascinating to me.
Cause it's not going to help.
No, it's not. It's not, and it's a horrible thing to do to them. They bring that shit up in therapy.
Right.
So
right.
I found it fascinating, and I started looking into it. And then I was like, I need to write a book about El Cuco. Now I finished it, and it hit me. I'm like, wait a minute, El Cuco for me is addiction, and that's why there's such a strong theme of addiction in the book, because, you know, that was my El Cuco, and so I like the fact that he can, I really am fascinated with supernatural monsters or beings that are, their shape is determined by your own fear.
Right.
I find that fascinating.
And you mentioned writing about, you know, that the addiction is a plot line in this book and also in your own life, it sounds like. So both Lupe's father and your character Javier battle addiction. Do you want to talk a little bit about writing about addiction? Because I think that that's really important to this book. And I think it's really important to teens to be able to read books like that.
Sure. I mean, that's actually what you just said is exactly why I do it.
Because
when I was younger, there were no stories about addiction specifically written for young people. And so I wanted to reach, you know, if I had read something like that, I think it would have made, you know, I would have realized I wasn't alone.
Right.
Luckily, I found Alateen when I was 13, and that helped quite a bit. But it definitely felt like I wasn't reading stories about people who were like me. And so to be able to maybe reach somebody who's dealing with this and feeling that their life is not under their control and having to, I mean, I was running the household from, you know, basically 10 to 13, to maybe reach one of those kids like I could have used, you know, is very appealing to me. And whether or not I intend to put it in a book, it comes through one way or another. Even I wrote picture books, some manuscripts, and it still manages to come through in its own way. It's like whenever these themes that are so, you know, embedded in your soul, to use a cliche, they come through whether you intend them to or not, you know?
Right.
And that's what sort of hit me with the El Cuco thing. I was like, oh my God, there it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. Now I have a question about characters. You know, we're talking a little bit about Javier. We talked a little bit about Lupe, and you also have a character, Marisol. I'm curious, as you have worked through these two books, did you find from a craft perspective that you see their character arcs as having two books to work through? Or do you sort of focus on, did you just focus on one book at a time, if that makes sense? Like when you were working on Five Midnights, did you know you would have another book because you had a two book deal and that these characters would continue to evolve and grow through two books?
I didn't. I really thought, I proposed a couple of different options to my editor, and I really thought one of the other ones was going to appeal to her, but she wasn't done with the characters either. But I didn't, you know, it was a complete book. You know, I sort of saw them get to that point. The interesting thing that happened to me is when I sat down to write Category 5, they had changed and evolved on their own. Mm-hmm. And I it sounds very woo-woo, but it really did happen. So that Lupe had come to peace, you know, it's a year later. She had sort of come to peace with some of her anger. And, but then Javier got angry, you know, as Javier is where I channeled my anger about how the U.S. handled, or didn't handle the hurricane, recovery in Puerto Rico.
That's really interesting. Cause my next question is literally written down, did anger fuel this novel at all?
Oh yeah. I mean, talking about themes, anti-colonialism comes through in pretty much everything I write, too, picture books included. So because I have these very strong feelings about this island, you know, whose culture is a mishmash of two oppressors and then, you know, this sort of indigenous history. And so it's something I think a lot about. And so when it came down to the hurricane and, you know, our president is throwing paper towels at them, I, like everyone, I was angry. And the interesting thing is that we went down a few months later. My uncle was like, no, I don't want you to come down. And so when I finally went down with my husband, and boy, it was still devastated. It was like February after the September hurricane. And I was like, why aren't you outraged? You should be outraged. I mean, we had no cell service for 2 days. The power kept going out. And this is, you know, 5 months later or 4 months later. And he said, what good would that do? I was like, I don't know. This is you change. And the thing is that the anger started to build for them as a culture. And then when the governor sort of abandoned them, they went to the streets. And I was honestly, that was one of the most powerful experiences I had, is watching that happen. And so I don't think that would happen again, because and when the earthquake hit, they rallied, and it's such a resilient island. It's a resilient culture.
Yeah. I have another question about anger, and I've wondered this before about people who write memoir and perhaps are pulling from trauma or painful pasts. And I'm wondering, just writing from a place of anger, is that ever a problem for finding a story? I don't know that I'm saying for you specifically, but if it's a conversation we can have about writing, you know, do you think that people have to work to let go of anger sometimes just in order to move forward with their work?
I think it would depend on what genre you're writing. If you're writing a memoir and you want it to be a quiet, contemplative piece, you know, it's hard to do that from anger. Mm-hmm. Horror is an outlet for anger, you know?
Yeah.
And so it seems like a more natural way to process that. But I think it sort of depends on what you want the book to be. I don't set out to deal with anger and to, you know, embed it in my writing, but it had happened with Category 5.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it took me years of therapy to even express my anger in general. So to be able to have an outlet for it and put it in, and process it through my characters has been very helpful.
Okay, great. Let's see. Anne, do you mind if I read a few lines from the book and then we can talk a little bit about suspense?
Absolutely.
Okay. So this is the final sentence of, I believe, the first chapter. He was out of earshot when the screaming began. Okay. And then this mm-hmm. is a sentence a bit further into the book, or it's more than a sentence, about, I think it's Lupe's perspective. She's with Javier. He nodded, his mouth a straight line, his eyes still in the distance. He looked over at her. What kind of people take advantage of a natural disaster to make money? Lupe looked right back at him. Monsters. Monsters were something they both knew a lot about. So I those were just two of many, many, many moments where you are so good at sort of creating a suspenseful moment and then sort of letting it sit with us before we move on. Because those are both, I believe, the last sentences of a chapter. So I just wonder if you want to talk a little bit about writing suspense and sustaining it when you, as the author, knows what's happening, which I think must be kind of hard to do. But what do you think?
It is. And I think I learned a lot while writing Five Midnights, especially with my editor, Allie Fisher. This is something we worked through from the first editorial letter is a way to build that up when, especially with YA, a lot of it, you know, from the back of the book, you know, so you have to sort of find a way to make it interesting and to put layers of tension. So if you know that it's the boogeyman, what about it can up the tension and make it, you know, so you sort of have to go from this perspective of they're going to have an understanding of this before they go in.
Right.
So what else am I going to pull from? But there were points definitely in the early drafts where it was like, I don't know whether it lagged in Five Midnights and then we pull it up. When I got to Category 5, what I did, I had a revelation. A writing revelation mm-hmm. after all these years. And I started plotting for the first time in my life. And I used to think that would interfere with the creative. Well, I was making my life more complicated. And so I plotted it out very carefully, okayed it with my editor, and then just wrote. And it was lean. When I sent that first copy, she said, honestly, this could be published as is.
Oh, wow.
But let's flesh out. And that is because all it was tension and action. And I think it was very screenplayerly, you know, very screenwriterly.
Right.
And so, and then we were able to sort of flesh out individual sort of personalities and whatever. But I started from this place of, I want to make sure that tension is a railroad, is like a train coming into the station that you can't stop.
Okay.
And so it really helped to start with that and then put flesh on the bone.
Ned, do you pull from any sort of standard YA outline advice as you're creating your own outline, or is that all you?
No, I had VCFA, Vermont College of Fine Arts, where I work and where I graduated from, is I've connected with this community of writers, and the support I get is tremendous. And I have one particular friend, Corey McCarthy, who is a young adult writer, and they are also a screenwriter. And so there's this sort of, I really feel that they're an expert in plotting. And mm-hmm. so when I was saying I looked at methods, you know, the snowflake method, the whatever, and my brain would shut off.
Right.
And so Corey has this method, which is based on screenplays for YA, particularly speculative fiction. And I took their method and just sort of took it from there, took the parts that made sense to me and left the rest. And it has changed everything because I didn't think that, you know, this, okay, you know, this needs to be the turning point. This needs to this, this needs to that. And then I started to pay attention to movies and things like that. And I was like, okay, well, this clearly works. And it was revelatory for me. So it is, you can take a method or something that, you know, a plotting structure that doesn't frighten you.
Right.
And then create your own. And so that's what I ended up doing. when I was in the adult program and I was running adult literature, it's less that tension. You know, you definitely can have tension and you should have it in things like horror, but you have more space to pontificate, to do settings and to have beautiful language. You know, and you have all those things in YA, but you have an audience who is not going to put up with a lot of pontificating.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm embracing plotting, and I find it, and Corey actually plots before writing, in the middle of the book, and then after having written, replots now, to sort of see where it has gone.
Corey and Amy Rose, is that right? We're on the show at one point.
Excellent.
Yeah, I talked to them about their first Sword in the Stone novel. I forget the title. That's terrible.
Once in Future. It's
yes.
You know, the queer King Arthur in space.
Yes,
yeah, Corey
it was really cool.
Is now on our faculty. Is now on our faculty, actually, because there is this sort of way of explaining plot that just got to me in a way that I hadn't before. So,
okay, cool.
But I have, you know, in the program working with Ellen Lesser and David Joss, I got all of these, you know, all these pieces of, all these gifts, all these pieces of gold that I now am able to make happen. But it took years of sort of people hammering stuff at me to get through to me.
Yeah. So this is a line that explains Lupe's closeness with her uncle, who is the cop we were mentioning before. Vanquishing mm-hmm. a supernatural demon bonds people, don't you know? I loved that. But it also refers to Five Midnights, and it made me wonder how it is to write a sequel and having to fill in the past for readers of the new book that maybe haven't read the old book, and whether there are other concerns that you had to address.
Yeah, it's tough because you have the first book so embedded in your, you know, unconscious. But we were, Tor and Allie were very particular that they wanted it to be able to be read by people who read the first one and people who hadn't.
Right.
And so, you know, I think of it almost like a companion novel because it isn't like the story continues, but it is a sequel. It's just that it has a different sort of storyline. So I had that in mind when I was writing and was trying to make sure that I didn't refer to things that would make people feel left out, you know, and if I did refer to something in the first book, give some context. And then, you know, Allie reads it and says, okay, I don't think, you know, this might be too much reference to the first book. And then you have additional people read it who have not read the first book and who can tell you, you know, in this place. So it was a lot of steps for that. But it is definitely something, you know, in this case, we really wanted it to be able to stand alone as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. And who are your readers, do you think? And do you know what the readership is like in Puerto Rico?
You know, unless it's translated, you know, there are more and more young people on the island reading in English.
Uh-huh.
In the past, there hasn't been a lot of market for books in English down there.
Right.
But that's changing now with the millennials and Gen Z. So I think for me, you know, my readership is are the freaks and geeks like I was, you know, I was a punk. And, you know, definitely people who like horror, who like, I don't know. I have a soft spot for the fringe people because that's what I was.
Okay.
And things have changed a bit, you know, with Gen Z. I mean, you know, there's a spectrum of identity that they can pull from and decide where they fall. And it's much less prescriptive than when we were kids. But I like to write for those people who are, one, dealing with issues in their home that they're feeling hopeless about, and two, sort of on the fringes. And the thing is that I think it still appeals to people. My son was, we were raised in Morrisville. He's a handsome guy. He was athletic. It was bizarre to me that I could have this child, but, he still felt like he was an outsider. And so I realized that really every teen, it's sort of the nature of being a teen.
Yeah.
You feel a certain amount of that. So there's some universality, but, the ones I really, you know, picture are people, you know, on the fringes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Let's see. The book is not genre romance. I want to point that out, but it does include teen romance. That's part of the story. So what for you were some of the rules for writing the romance that you put in this book? And is that a conversation you have with an editor, what the rules are for writing romance for teen readers? Or
my agent, Linda Camacho, who actually also went to BCFA, is the one who sort of got me. She has a lot of romance clients, and she sort of sent me some sites and some guidelines of how to write romantic relationships. So it is, I always want it to be there because I love them too. I'm not the person to write it when romance is the theme. But, you know, I want it to be there on some level to be, you know, some sort of adds to the tension, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And so my editor definitely, from my agent to my editor, we talked about how you best write that. My focus is always on the story and the characters versus the sort of romantic aspect, but every teen wants it, or not every, but most. And I, like I said, I do too. I love having that love interest, or at least the possibility. It just adds to the complexity. So, you know, at this point in my life, I'm not necessarily somebody who's going to read romances. I never was necessarily, but I do like a good, you know, romance, particularly, you know, love triangles and things like that. Just makes it even more interesting.
Yeah, it does. Can we talk about the points of view? Changing points of view in a narrative and deciding who's the right person or set of people to tell a story.
Yeah, you know, I didn't set out to do that. I started with just Lupe.
Yeah.
And then I realized that I needed an addict's viewpoint. And I had never written from a male perspective. I did one short story in the program, but this was sort of only the second time I've written from a male perspective. And I found that he was even more interesting to me than Lupe. And so I like the idea of having these two different viewpoints. You know, I did hesitate. Lupe is more my story because there's the, you know, is it my story to tell concern. But Javier has definitely parts of my story as well. Mm-hmm. I've never lived on the island for more than a few months at a time. And so it was a bit of a stretch. But I was very careful and respectful of him. And I think it worked well. The interesting thing is Marisol I was sitting in a balcony in Puerto Rico with a Dominic Stansberry at the writing residency.
Right.
And I said, we were talking about what you brought up earlier about tension. And he said, well, you know, you need you can add in a human element, a villain, you know, somebody amused to the evil. And I was like, oh, and it was another revelatory moment. And so I went home and started thinking about it. And that's what Marisol started as.
Okay.
What's interesting is she ended up being my editor's like, oh, I love this character. Oh, I love this character. And so she ended up being much more rounded. And then in the end, she's sort of pulled into this curse. But it was interesting how she started as not a red herring, but a bit of a, you're not sure where she, you know, what part she plays in this.
Right.
And then she ended up being my favorite character as well. And then in category five, she's crucial. So it's just sort of interesting where they emerge from, you know, these characters.
Yeah, and I think a character that you can't quite read, it makes everything so much more complex and interesting. I mean, I don't want to be teased right through to the end of a book, but I find like a not necessarily trustworthy character or one you haven't figured out yet makes you keep reading. I mean, I just want to know, who is this person? Why are they doing these things?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And she was my anti-colonialist.
Yes.
Feelings. That's what I put into her. And so, you know.
And that is another aspect of the plot that I was going to bring up is you have a storyline in here about a former Navy base that was on this part of Puerto Rico. Vieques, is that right?
Vieques, yep.
Vieques. And, you know, I just found that really interesting. How much do you feel like you like infusing politics or history into the narrative, partly, you know, to educate your readers, but partly because it's part of the culture, whether it's a great part or not. So do you want to just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I never set out to put in politics. Honestly, you know, I politics frightens me in a way. And so, but they say that politics in Puerto Rico is the national sport. Mm. And so it is definitely ingrained into the culture. And so, and it's interesting that the novel I wrote, the adult novel I wrote, now politics is coming into it, and I did not anticipate that. So I think it sort of has to be dealt with, and it wouldn't be responsible, particularly to deal with something like the hurricane, without bringing elements of that in.
Sure.
It is never, you know, on Twitter, I don't do politics, and a friend of mine's like, look, you know, your brand is political. You can certainly do that. But I also don't want to stop conversations or start confrontations on things like that. I just feel like I'm interested in the aspect of politics, the human aspect, the daily person's aspect, the, you know, how it affects their daily lives.
Right.
It's almost like an anthropological viewpoint of that. And I find that interesting, yeah. But I never set out to do that.
Well, and it's interesting because the way that one explains their own politics, like on Twitter, is different than presenting it through a storyline, through characters, and making it organic to a plot, you know? And
absolutely.
Yeah, it is. Let's talk a little bit about other books. Do you have maybe a couple books that you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
Sure. I read pretty much half adult and half young adult because mm-hmm. I write young adult, so I need to sort of keep up on things. So I just finished Afterlife by Julia Alvarez.
Oh, yeah.
Who is a Vermont writer, and she lives in Middlebury, and a friend and just a person of light. She is just so supportive of other writers. And she is pretty much my favorite writer. Her Butterflies book was one of the most powerful books of my
right in youth. the time of the butterflies
and that's interesting because that brings in the history piece that you were talking about,
right.
So I read everything she writes, and Afterlife is so interesting because it's, first of all, it takes place in Vermont. It's about grief, which is something I write about a lot, having lost a parent young, and it's just immigration. It's just beautifully written, and
yeah.
It's a novel of a different time in her life. And as somebody who's, you know, 57, I loved it because it really was just a different viewpoint at a different, the protagonist's life was at a different point than anything else she'd written. So I love that. I also, Elysium Girls is one I read recently. And it is steampunk. It's a YA novel. And it's steampunk and Western and post-apocalyptic. And it's by Kate Pentecost is the author. And it just has like all the things I love. And I really enjoyed that.
Oh, great.
And so those are two that I have really enjoyed recently.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Now, you mentioned that you are working on an adult novel. Is that the only thing you're working on right now? What are you thinking will come next for your readers?
Well, next is sort of a secret project.
Okay.
For HarperCollins. I teased intellectual property is when the editor came up with the concept and then has writers audition. And you write, you know, they give you two pages, outline the characters and the concept, and then you write three scenes. And it was a horror rom-com, is what I'm going to tell you. And I heard that, you know, horror rom-com, I'm like, I'm in, you know, I'm in. And so I did three scenes and went off to Puerto Rico and expected there would be another round. And I got an offer while I was in Puerto Rico. And so it's incredibly exciting. Yeah.
That's so cool.
The thing that's interesting about IPs, I was actually coming off the mountain in El Yunque when I heard my agent's ring. She has her own ring. And I was like shaking. I was like, why is she calling?
Right.
But the thing about IPs that I didn't understand is that, yes, the concept comes from somewhere else, but the writer has, well, it depends on obviously on the editor and the particular book, but the writer has so much more not control, you know, of the story. And so, you know, it's all with the blessing of the house, but, and the editor, but you really can put your own mark on it. And that's what she liked about it. And so I'm liking this thing because the thing is that they come up with concepts that are more commercial and they're going to have more of a reach than my weird stories. the things that come up on my own are weird and they're less likely to be universal. And it's not that I want to be a famous writer. That's not it at all. But I would like, you know, everybody wants to reach people with their stories. And, you know, the more people you can reach, especially when you're talking about teens and you're trying to reach them about particular issues, the better. And so I have had a ball with this book. And so I can't wait to talk about what it's about. But, NDA.
It's interesting the way it came to you. It's almost like there's almost like a freedom to a frame, right? There's almost mm-hmm. like a freedom to mm-hmm. Because you don't flounder trying to figure out, I'll just call it sort of the universe. You already know what you're supposed to contain it mm-hmm. to, and that must be kind of refreshing. I don't know, different.
You absolutely have caught it. I mean, I hadn't anticipated that.
Yeah.
And I just had a blast. And I did this. I also plotted this very carefully and made sure she was on board with all of it. And then it just came. And so I actually wrote a draft of this in 5 weeks because I had spent so much time. It's sort of like, my husband's a painter. Uh-huh. And he spends about 5/6 of the time when he's painting a room, taping and preparing. And then the painting piece is a small piece of it. And that's sort of how I feel about plotting, is that you plot it well and you get all the elements and the chapters outlined, whatever. And then I would just paste on the top the paragraph about the chapter and go and write it. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like the work was already done. And now I was just putting it down on paper. So it was a blast.
Yeah. Now, how did it come to you? Did your agent bring it to you? The call for submission?
Yes. And my agent, you know, I let her know I'm game for these things. I would like to build a writing life. I would like to eventually be able to, you know, write full time like so many of us will. And this is a sort of way to do that mm-hmm. and to be able to write my weird stories. Mm-hmm. So I told her, I said, look, anything comes up that's interesting, because I'd only auditioned once before and I got it, but they killed the project. And so I said, any IPs that look like me? And she said, you know, horror, rom-com. I was like, I'm in.
That's
and
me.
So, yeah. And so she, you know, she keeps that in mind and then sends me the information. But they give you like, you know, 2-page summaries and you go. And so it's a lot of fun. It's almost like a writing exercise, but in a bigger scale.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to just come back to category 5 a little bit more before we finish up. Ghosts figure prominently in the novel, and I'm not going to give anything away or go deeply into that plot line, but I am curious, as I read, I was curious if you believe in ghosts.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, hell yeah. And you know what's sort of interesting about the supernatural when it comes to Latinos, and my friend William Alexander, who's a middle grade writer, incredible. He has this thing. He's like, in this culture, we're like, you got to vanquish the monster. You got to vanquish the ghost. You got to get rid of them. And he says, every other culture in the world just accepts them. And so in Puerto Rico, you know, there's no question that there are ghosts, you know, that pressure at the bottom of your bed is your grandmother sitting there. This is part of the culture. And so I have grown up sort of with that around me. My mother was very woo-woo. You know, if you told her there was a ship, mothership over Stowe, and, you know, they were affecting, you know, the electricity, she would have believed you. It's sort of like I've inherited that. I don't disbelieve anything.
Right.
It's like I start from that. And so I do definitely believe in ghosts. And, you know, College Hollow is haunted at Vermont College.
Is that right?
And I've had, Anna. So one of our employees did research and found out that there was a love triangle in the 1800s, and a woman was shot by another woman.
Oh, wow.
And she's the concept is that the ghost in College Hall is Anna. And so I actually wrote for that lockdown anthology. I was like, who does a ghost haunt if nobody's there? Because we're not there, you know, we're working from home. And so I have her haunting through Zoom and coming through to us through video meetings. And so it was a lot of fun to do. But I definitely, supernatural, I have it in part of my bio that I'm preparing for the zombie apocalypse. It's partially a joke. It's partially like, okay, you know, we're having a pandemic, so I can handle it better because at least there's no zombies, you know? So great. I absolutely believe it all. Yeah.
Now, my last question is always a question of advice for writers. And in your case, I wanted to talk about a character that you include in the book. I believe he was in both books, Professor Quiñones.
Oh, yeah, I love him.
Yeah, he's great. And he's a cultural anthropologist, and he kind of helps fill in the blanks for your characters as they investigate the mysteries of the books. He made me think about how an author can people her mysteries with helpful experts and clues and hypotheses. So I wonder if you can offer any advice for this process and finding characters like Professor Quiñones that might, you know, first of all, be a great character, but also kind of help along the mystery.
I love this question.
Oh, good.
And it's so easy for it to seem like a plot point, a tool. You know, this person serves a purpose. And you don't want that. You want them to be sort of integral to the story. And so he is actually based on a relative too. And I'm not going to say who, because I mean, he's passed on, but it was like this sort of, and he sort of represents an old school academic that I had encountered at Columbia myself. And, you know, and so I was able to sort of pull together people from my life to give him three dimensions, but he also sort of serves that purpose. And how you have experts who are not just sort of like enter stage right.
Right.
Expert. And so that is something I think about a lot, actually. I started an eco horror novel based in Puerto Rico, an adult novel. I'm fascinated with eco horror, just sort of the idea, because we're living it, you know, and how to have an expert come into that. But you don't want to, if you're following an expert, if they're your main character, you have to be an expert. And I am not an expert in anything.
Right.
And so you know, and so the idea of being able to have it as a secondary character, do your research as much as you need to, you know, they're going to forgive a lot, you know, it doesn't have to be, but you also don't want to do something that they're going to say, oh no, you know, that is just not true.
Right.
And so you sort of, it's this balance of doing enough research to make it believable and not piss off real experts.
Right.
But also, you know, and so, and anthropology is something I've mentioned several times. It's something that I've studied. It's interesting to me. And that's what this person actually did. And a cultural anthropologist. And so it's to be able to round it out with somebody from your life and then without, you know, being sued and then have it be a more meaningful, anchor instead of just a tool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Now, it's interesting. So the first book was Five Midnights, and the second book was Category 5, and Quiñones is a name that concerns the number 5, and I was wondering if that was intentional.
Oh, no. I like that. Thank you. And I don't even know why it's 5. Actually, Five Midnights is something that 14 came up with. We, you know, it was originally called El Cuco. And my editor's like, you're not doing the book justice. That's not what it's about.
Right.
And so, you know, we sort of got to that point and went through the whole process of coming up with and then originally Category 5, I had what the hurricane brought was my title.
Mm-hmm.
And that's too, it's not horror and punchy enough. And so I was like, wait, Cat 5, you know, just cut it down.
Right.
So yeah, the whole two books just sort of came together so beautifully.
Yeah.
It was an incredible process.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, listen, Anne, it has been a pleasure to speak to you. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Category 5 by Anne Davila Cardinal, published by Tor Teen. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you. It was a very enjoyable interview. And I love that you bring in craft. I have so much fun talking about craft. So thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Anne Davila Cardinal. You can learn more about her work at her website, annedavilacardinal.com, and you don't need the accent mark to get you there. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Anne Davila Cardinal. She says it's not a prompt, exactly, but an exercise in encouragement. Get three smallish pieces of paper. On the first one, write down your short-term writing goals, say for the next week, even day by day. It can be to write 1,000 words, or finish a chapter of revision, or journal every day for a week. On the second piece of paper, write down your goal for the year. Send out a certain number of submissions, finish a full draft, pull together a poetry chapbook, whatever that looks like for you. And finally, on the third, write down your long-term writing goals: to be published as a writer, to teach writing, to publish a book a year or every other year, to build a writing life. Take those three pieces of paper and put them in three different places. Put the first one somewhere that you will see it every day. When the week is over, look at it and assess how you did. Adjust your goals for the next week accordingly. Put the second piece of paper away somewhere nearby, but not in immediate sight, somewhere where you might find it over the next year and be reminded. A jewelry box, maybe in a book that you look at a couple times a year, maybe in the toolbox. For the third one, Anne recommends doing what Dr. Terari Trent suggests in her book, The Awakened Woman: plant your dreams, either in a garden or a pot that you use for a plant, or even a park. Visit the place you planted your dreams as often as you need to, but trust that you are creating intentional rootedness. Anne says, if this is too woo-woo for you, don't worry about planting it. Write down your three levels of goals and work towards them, period. The point is, build that writing life your way. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Speaking about next week on the show, my guest will be Grey Wolf Press director and publisher Fiona McCrae. It's July, and our situations remain mostly the same. We are wearing masks, we are social distancing, we are trying to stay well. I hope that however isolated you are, you're able to read and write. And if possible, I hope you're able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, participating in their virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write these days, be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode does offer a prompt, exercise, or activity written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. So as far as supporting authors by attending their online events, let's talk about the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. The Northshire Bookstore and Manchester Center presents a virtual literary conversation. Mamta Chowdhury, author of Haunting Paris, will be in conversation with Jim Shepherd. That's Tuesday, July 7th at 5, hosted by Northshire. You can find out more information at northshire.com. There are several events going on this Wednesday, July 8th. On July 8th at 7, the Vermont Humanities Council will host Ryan Krieger, author of How to Make Friends as an Adult. You can find information about that event on Vermont Humanities Council's Facebook page or the digital programs section of their website. Also on July 8th at 6:30, the Fletcher Free Library presents an online discussion on Zoom of E.B. Zoboy's American Street. More information by emailing bshatara@burlingtonvt.gov. Bear Pond Books will be hosting former Write the Book guest Ginny Sassaman for her launch of the book Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. That's at 7 o'clock on Wednesday. You can find more information at bearpondbooks.com. Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center also presents Alice Miller, author of More Miracle Than Bird, in conversation with Christopher Castellani. That's Thursday, July 9th at 5, another virtual event, and you can find more information at northshire.com. The Fletcher Free Library will be presenting a series called Write, 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 a Grab the Mic, Tell Your Story video series for young people. It's meant to be an entertaining and inventive way to engage with the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, Jason Reynolds. You can read more about it and find out how to participate by going to the Fletcher Free Library's website, fletcherfree.org. This week, that will take place on July 7th at 10:30 and July 9th at 10:30. I believe those are for different age groups, though you might want to read more about it if you're interested on their website, fletcherfree.org. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.